Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 143 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week is a fantastic funky guitarist who brings to mind the great players from earlier generations while making the music all his own, Jimmy James. The Seattle musician's newest band, Parlor Greens, released its first album, In Green We Dream, this past week. Parlor Greens is an instrumental organ trio featuring Hammond player Adam Scone of the Sugarman 3, drummer Tim Carman of GA20, and James. You may know James for his work with another organ trio, the Del Von Lamar Organ Trio. Del Von Lamar was featured on episode 33 of Caro Pop, but James is no longer playing with them. Why? He discusses that here. James also is a longtime member of a larger Seattle band, the True Loves, which sports a horn section and percussionist, but even amid all those players, James's crisp, inventive work shines through. James is one of those guitarists who never plays more than is needed, yet can step into the spotlight and seize any moment. This is no wonder when you hear about his influences in the early rock, soul, and funk years. You can hear previous Caro Pop guest Steve Cropper of Booker T and the MGs in his playing, but also Seattle guitar hero Jimi Hendrix. It turns out James has a personal connection to Hendrix as well. How did James become so passionate about so much music released before he was born? How did he learn to play? Did he think of guitar more as a melodic or rhythmic instrument? How important are the guitars themselves and the gear? With Parlor Greens, how did he wind up in an all-star organ trio? Was he looking for that format again after leaving the Del Von Lamar organ trio? How do their songs come together? Does James play differently in an organ trio than in the True Loves? Would he ever do a solo album? And how tough have the previous 2 years been for James? Aside from the split from Lamar, James lost his mother, who inspired and supported him in so many ways. The way he talks about his mother here is as lyrical, heartbreaking, and uplifting as any music he'll ever play. If you don't know Jimmy James and his music already, you are in for a treat. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Jimmy James.
In one of the other groups I played with, we were in Brazil. I bought that flag, one for myself, and I bought one for my mother, and I bought a bracelet for her because she always wanted something from Brazil. She always wanted something from Brazil, and I got it for her, and then I ended up having her wear it at her funeral too, so. Yeah, it was that was something, you know. So she was wearing that and my favorite ring. So,
no, that's nice. Was that band True Loves, or which band were you in Brazil with?
The former group D'Lo 3.
Right. So yeah, I talked to Del Von a couple of years ago for this. You were in D'Lo 3, and now you're in Parlor Greens, and you've also been in True Love.
I used to be. I left about a year and a half ago.
Right. From
D'Lo 3.
Right. Yeah. You were in it. Yeah. And now you're doing Parlor Greens. So you got a different organ trio going on. And then you also have the big band, True Loves. And I'm wondering how you approach what you're doing differently when you're playing in a trio versus a big band like that.
Not too much difference, maybe a little more. It's more of just finding the part that sticks and finding the part that works that doesn't get in the way, you know, especially when you have horns. But I think it's not much of a difference. It's just more, I just stay kind of in my lane, you know, with trying not to get in the horn parts way, same thing with the organ. So it's almost pretty much similar.
Is there one format you prefer to the other?
Not really. I mean, it just, as long as I get to play, you know, that's all that matters. And getting to play like the stuff that really dig, you know, like that's more up my alley, you know. So it's like I don't perform one more than the other, because I mean, I've been with the True Loves for like we were celebrating actually our 10-year anniversary. Our first show we ever played together was August 10th or August 11th, you know, of 2014. So it's been 10 years.
You can have a big 10th anniversary show for that.
I don't know if we do, probably.
Right. And then Parlor Greens, are you hitting the road with them as well? Or I know that that album is just about to come out.
Yeah, I believe there's supposed to be some stuff coming up in the fall. I know that. We're supposed to do some shows with The Dip in the South And I think there might be one in the East Coast with Kelly Finnegan, I believe. And there's some stuff in the new year.
Have you played a lot of shows with them already or not so much?
We did a private event in New York. It was a private event with us and the Monophonics. And we haven't, like, it was the first time we played those songs since we recorded them. So it was pretty, we were just trying to get the cobwebs off, figure out how to play them again. We were like, oh, God, this is going to be interesting. We heard them, but how do we play them? But we ran through it and got through it.
Was that a Coal Mine Records party or?
I think it might have been something with the booking agency, from what I believe.
How did you and Adam Scone and Tim Carman end up in a room together playing with each other?
Well, from what I know, I'll backtrack a bit because I know Adam from a thing that we did in L.A. And then I did a recording session for him under Daptone where Gabe Roth produced it. And then Tim, I know him from GA20. And I think there was like, I think Tim and Terry had talked about getting something together. And it was like a project they were talking about doing. And so we talked about it. Months went by, you know, we kept talking about it. And so it was like, I think, and then Terry was like, hey, I'm gonna get you guys out here to Loveland, Ohio. And so we went there and Adam came through because Adam was living in Miami and you know, Tim is in Boston. And so we got there. And what I recall from that, Terry and I were talking about something. I can't remember what it was, but we were talking. And all I remember was hearing Tim and Adam bang away, like, in the studio, right? But we had just flown in, most of us. I mean, I think Tim drove, but most of us flew in. And I remember we just started jamming, and all of a sudden, West Memphis came out of that. Right. That was the first song that I think we started playing. And actually, I think the tune is a lot longer than that, but I know that that was just one of the things we just started playing, and that's what happened.
So did you just start coming up with a riff, and it all just kind of came together on that? Or
yeah, I think it might have been, if I recall, I think Adam started playing something, and I just joined in with him, and Tim joined in, and it just happened, you know? And stuff. And I mean, I know Adam had some stuff, some ideas. Tim had some ideas. And I know that a lot of the music that we played was stuff that we either never got to play in certain situations, you know, Tim with certain stuff, Adam with certain stuff, with me certain stuff, you know. So we just did that, you know, and tried out different ideas and made up some stuff on the spot. And, you know, and like, hey, I got this little riff thing or this little chord progression. And, you know, and or Adam plays something for me, and you know, or Tim plays something for me, you know, and worked out.
Were you looking to get into another organ trio at that point, or was Terry Cole trying to get you into another organ trio at that point?
No, it wasn't that. It was just, you know, I didn't, it was kind of like, you know, I wasn't even really thinking about it. It was just kind of like, you know, it's like, sure, you know, I'll play with Adam, you know, and stuff like that, because I play with him, you know, on that recording, Brooklyn to Brooklyn. And so, you know, I was just kind of just like, let's just see what happens. You know, I don't want to refuse it and say no, you know, because I want to just like give it a chance, you know, and stuff like that. And knowing that I've talked to these guys over the years, you know, and I'll say, you know what, let's try this. Let's just have some fun, you know. And that's what I was looking forward to doing, is just having fun and seeing wherever the wind blows, you know. So that's how I looked at it. And it turned out like, I was very happy with like hearing certain stuff, because we were just going with it, you know, and just going with the flow, and let's play things we wouldn't play, you know, or stuff that we haven't done before, you know. And that was just, and the ideas of sharing those ideas was great, you know. So a lot more healthier situation in that regard, you know.
So how did that feel, like the dynamic and the give and take among all of you compared to, you know, the organ trio you've been in for several years with Delvon Lamar?
It's a lot different, you know. It's just more of, you know, taking time, hearing things out, you know, and just a really relaxed environment, you know, really relaxed environment. And a very cool one, you know, that's what I've seen from it. And it was just like, you know, and just gathering with friends and just having a great old time, you know, and just throwing caution to the wind. And, you know, and that's how I looked at it.
Is your input into the creation of the songs different than it was with the other band?
Not really much different, you know, like it's more of just the energy was different, you know, the energy was different. And I just had a lot of fun, you know, more so.
Are there things that you hoped the Delvon Lamar organ trio would accomplish that you now want to accomplish with Parlor Greens?
To be quite honest, I'm not, in truth, you know, I can't say what that was going to be. You know, they do what they do, you know. At the end of the day, I'm a lot more relaxed and I'm having a lot more fun, you know, to be quite honest.
And in terms of goals with this band, is there anything beyond we just want to make some cool music and get out there? Or is there some sort of grand plan in mind?
You know, truth be told, I look at it like this. I'm not even thinking about it, really. You know, I guess, to be quite honest, I'm just more of just like, after, you know, having, you know, kind of, you know, really hard year, you know, within the 2 years, actually, I look at the future as every second or every minute from now, you know, and I really just, wherever it's going to go, I'm happy wherever that may, where it may land us. You know what I mean? I'm pretty just stoked that I get to hang out with people who are positive and just fun to be around and musically, you know, and both groups, you know, whether it's Baller Greens or the True Loves, you know, I'm just happy wherever that may go, you know.
And when you're talking about the past 2 years and being difficult, you're talking about the end of you being in the DLO3?
this is a tough question. It's like, it's just like leaving that. Well, first foremost, the thing that was difficult was my mother passing. That was the hardest thing in the world, you know, after my sister had passed 4 years before that, you know. And so my sister was my last sibling. My mother was the last of who I had left in the world.
Wow. I'm really sorry.
And so, you know, that and having to be watch my mother pass in front of me was the hardest thing in the world that I ever had to deal with, you know, because she's always been my rock and always been my, you know, my heart and my strength, you know, for everything. And if it wasn't for her, I would have, you know, she gave me the courage to go do this. I would have never would have thought, you know, and she saw far ahead than where I could see it. And so it was that, you know, and then, you know, leaving DLO 3, I'll put it this way, you know, even though I left it, I'm a lot happier since the departure, since parting ways with them.
Was that like an artistic thing at that point, or was it more sort of just personal interactions?
Let's just say it's a long story. it's a long story, to be quite honest. I will say I'm more in a positive situation than I was.
Right.
It is what it is. You know?
Well, I'm sorry it came to that, but anyway, it's great to hear you in another organ trio making really cool music again. So, you know, I'll have to see Parlor Greens. You'll have to come to Chicago soon and, you know, and
yeah,
bring the True Loves along with you too, although that's probably harder to tour with that big band.
Yeah, I mean, we sometimes have a scale back band because I know certain people have their families and stuff and they can't make it. But I mean, as far as this rejuvenation of, you know, being in the Parlor Greens and the True Loves, which, you know, hopefully both will do a show together eventually. I love those guys. I love those guys in the True Loves. They are the sweetest guys in the world, you know, and my mother loved them. She loved them to pieces, you know, and stuff like that. And they were there during my mother's funeral and stuff like that. And so they were really a very great support, you know, on that. And, you know, and stuff like that. And she loved the Dapper Derp. That was her favorite song because you had me play that a million times over and over again. Like, I love that song. I want to hear it again, you know? So, but yeah, we, yeah. So they, she loved those guys, and those guys have been very supportive. And we're supposed to go back on the road again in little increments, but it works, you know, and playing with Tim and, you know, Adam, you know, I love talking on the phone with him for a while. We just, we'll sit about, just talk about random stuff. And Tim, same thing, you know, it's great to play amongst friends and people that you care about and people who are just, you know, it's just, and just have a good energy all around, you know, it's a great thing, you know, to have.
Do you view Parlor Greens or the True Loves as, is one of them like your main band and one the side band, or are they both like, you know, 1A and 1B?
You know what? They're both, they're bands for different reasons, you know, and stuff like that, you know, being that Parlor Greens has more of, you know, you have the jazz soul element, you know, and stuff. And then with the True Loves, you have the soul instrumental kind of pop, but not, you know, in a good way, you know?
Right.
And it's just, you know, and it's just, and plus, you know, it's like True Loves has a party vibe to it too, you know, and stuff like that. So it's always fun, you know, and, you know, reminiscent of the days of like, you know, the Motown instrumentals and stuff with the Funk Brothers and stuff. And so that's very where it is, but it's, you know, our own thing, you know, we're inspired by different people, you know, and everybody has a different thing to bring to the table, you know? So it's always great, you know? And
it's got that sort of, it's got that Memphis horns thing going on too.
Right. You know, it's just like, you know, you listen to, you know, the Bar Keys and stuff like that.
That's what I was thinking about.
Or the like Soul Finger by the Bar Keys, you know.
One of my favorite songs.
You know, and yeah. And it's just, it's a lot of that. It's a lot of people bringing different elements into the table, you know, and it's just like, you know, somebody will come in, they got this idea, or they got something modern, but they also got this idea from Dapper Derp. That was inspired by Dyke and the Blazers, you know, and stuff like that. Cause I just dig Dyke and the Blazers, you know, to have their funky Broadway out, you know, and I was actually hip to them from another band that I play with on a weekly when I can make it, called F2D at the Sea Monster on Friday nights. And, you know, was hip to, let a woman be a woman, let a man be a man, you know? And then my mother hit me to funky Broadway and stuff like that, and more of the Dyke and the Blazers and stuff like that. And that's how I got into them. And TSU Tornadoes is another favorite group that I love listening to too.
Right. You're obviously really well-versed in music that came out before you were born. And I kind of have a similar sort of thing that I was always very into like 60s music, whether it's like sort of Beatles, British Invasion, or like 60s soul and Stax. What got you into, you know, the eras and types of music that you got into when you were a kid growing up?
Oh, that's easy. My mother's records. Like,
nice.
It was, I'll be honest, when I was a teenager, honestly, I used to feel like I was born in the wrong era, you know, because I never could find people. I was like, you know, I would be listening to like Wilson Pickett, you know, Mustang Sally a lot, you know, and then like, I would discover like my mother's records, like her 45s, like Junior Walking All-Star, Shotgun, or Curtis Mayfield's Real Winner was my first introduction to the Impressions, you know? And it was just like, the music was all the way around. I'll bring it like this. My oldest sister was into classical and pop. So I heard like Henry Mancini, Bach, stuff like that. But then she liked George Michael, you know? Stuff like that, or Lionel Richie or Cyndi Lauper, you know. And then my middle sister, because I'm the baby, I'm the only boy, she was the metalhead of the family and classical, like classic rock. So she loved Metallica. She was the hugest Rush fan you ever saw in your life, like huge Rush fan. At every album they ever made, from 2112 to Roll the Bones. She was the one who introduced me to Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin and Yes and Judas Priest and all that. And then my mom was the, we all took our cue from her because she was so well-rounded. She loved I heard everything from country western like Patsy Cline and Loretta Lynn to Motown Stax, then Elmer James, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, all the blues stuff, B.B. King and rock and roll. And she liked Mamas and the Papas, the Carpenters, you know. And so hearing all that, but I dug into mostly her blues records, like Jimmy Reed and all that, you know, and Bobby Boo Bland. But then it came also like Mustangs, like Wilson Pickett, Aretha, Sam Cooke, especially love Sam Cooke, Solomon Burke, the list, Sam and Dave, to Smokey Robinson, the Temptations. She was a huge Temptations fan. That's how I got into guitar, was listening to My Girl and hearing I Second That Emotion by the Miracles.
Right.
And that's how I got into a lot of that. And then, you know, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, you know, and stuff like that. And then a lot of gospel stuff like the Andre Crouch or the Walter Hawkins singers and stuff like that. So I heard a lot of that because she, you know, she either in the kitchen cooking, but there was always a record playing no matter what, you know. And if she was in the car, she had her little Maxell tapes. She would copy it and then put it in the car. And I'd be in the back seat. And I hear like Sly and the Family Stone, Thank You for Talking to Me, Africa, songs like that, that I can recall from like 3 years old, maybe four.
Wow.
A lot of those songs, you know. And so that music spoke to me in a way because I love the lyricism. I love that the music was, it had a simplicity, but yet complex thing to it. And that was something that it was just, I would always dig through my mother's records sometimes, you know, or like, you know, if I'm like, you know, my mother put it on, I would come in and I'm like, pull out a record and I would read the backs of records while listening. I would be in front of the speaker doing that all the time, you know? And so my mother did understand. She's like, what do you know about that? She knows I got into a lot of that stuff, you know, Marvin Gaye, Tammy Terrell, You're All I Need to Get By, you know, stuff like that. She couldn't understand it. She just like, I was just heavy into that, you know. But my peers were like, what are you listening to? Wilson Pickett, who's that? I'm like, huh. Wicked Pickett? You don't know who that is? You know, and then got to a high school band at the age of 15, which most high school bands play jazz. But we didn't want to play that. We wanted to play funk and rhythm and blues. And so somewhere, I think I have on a CD, thank God it was saved, there's a recording of a high school talent show and we're playing Kool & the Gang's Hollywood Swingin'.
Nice.
You know? And my mother listened to it. I was just like, Mom, what's that song? She's like, oh, that's Hollywood Swingin'. And I listened to it over and over and over again. And then I said, high school, we should play this song. We play stuff by James Brown, you know, even, you know, we listened to, I remember my mother listened to a lot of Otis Redding, you know, and we would play, we would in high school band, whatever we just liked to hear, we're like, let's play this by James Brown, or let's play this by Kool & the Gang. We played Jungle Boogie. We used to listen to Funk Incorporated, which was another great jazz, I guess you would say it was a quartet, but my mother had that album and we were just hit. We wanted stuff that grooved us, you know. And nothing against jazz. We, you know, jazz was cool, we loved it, but we wanted to play stuff that grooved us, that made people, right, you know, dance and move, you know, and so that's the stuff. And still listen to that. Idris Muhammad, you know, doing the Express Yourself and Super Bad. You know, that my sister actually, my middle sister had that record, you know, and that was just the stuff we loved to play, just groove.
Sure. Were there players when you were listening to the stuff and you thought, oh, you know, Steve Cropper or whoever else, like, I want to be doing that in this kind of music. Like, what got you, you know, what made you think, okay, guitar is my thing in this music?
Well, it was like, at first, like, the person I was really influenced by was Chuck Berry. And Pat O'Hare, who most people wouldn't know, but he played on a lot of the early stuff with Bobby Boo Bland, you know, on or Farther On Up the Road. But then when I got into, I remember the guitars that really got into me was, and it, I think it was Steve, I believe it was Steve Cropper played on this too, because I love this song when I was in kindergarten, Who's Making Love by Johnny Taylor.
Oh, right, great
one. And like Steve Cropper, of course, I didn't know who he was at the time. But as I got older, I started to understand, like, that was him who played on Walking the Dog by Rufus Thomas. You know, that's another one I love to play. Curtis Mayfield, love his playing. You know, a lot of people don't know he's the one who influenced Jimi Hendrix a lot. Jimi Hendrix scared the living daylights out of me, but I loved it. You know, like, but.
Plus, you're both fellow Seattle people, right? So he's like hometown hero for you.
Well, he's a hometown hero, and also my close relationship with him, in a way, is that my mother's cousin and her late husband both went to school with, they both went to Garfield with Jimi Hendrix. They were in the same class together.
Oh, wow.
And Jimi Hendrix played in her husband's first band called the Rocking Kings. You can actually look him up. They played in two bands together. They played in a group called the Velvetones and the Rocking Kings. And if you actually look up the photo of Hendrix playing at Washington Hall, I think it's 1960, you'll see him playing a white super guitar. There's a drummer, two horn players, and you'll see in the back of a guy's head playing piano. That's my mother's cousin's late husband, Robert Green, who played, and that's my first cousin's grandfather. And so they played, and then my sister's best friend, her cousin, which her mom was the aunt of, her name was Betty Jean, and she was the one who inspired Red House. And Red House is about Betty Jean, who Jimi Hendrix wanted to marry.
Okay.
And at the end of the song, he says, you know, if my baby don't love me no more, I know her sister will. And found out her sister's name was Maddie, was who he was talking about. And they lived in a house. Actually, the house was actually brown, but Betty Jean's hair was red. And the house is still owned by the family that he's talking about, that he played on the stage. And that's what the song is about.
So how much of an influence was Hendrix on your playing?
Pretty big influence. What I loved about Hendrix to me was he represented freedom, you know, in the way musically, the way he played and the way he dressed and his philosophy. Really, you know, of course, I was born, you know, 11 years too late to have met him. I wanted to meet him because I didn't know who he was. I thought he was current. My sister played his music. I thought it was heavy metal at the time. And so I was really like, who? And when I got to teenage years, I asked my sister, I said, where can I go see him perform? Is he ever touring? Is there any show I can go see him play? And my sister had to just unlock the bad news. She's like, how do I break this? So she told me, and then I was like, I was so disappointed. I was so sad. So I had to, you know, when you could go rent, Blockbuster Video? That was the time you could rent VHS. My mom would go and we would go rent tapes. She wanted movies she wanted to go see. So she'd say, pick out a tape. And I picked out the Jimi Hendrix documentary. And so when I got to watch him play the national anthem at Woodstock, I was like, I didn't know a guitar could do that, you know? And it was just, and I couldn't believe he was from the era that they said he was, because he just didn't sound like it, you know? And, but at the same time, also diving back in, I listened to a lot of B.B. King, you know, a lot of B.B. King, Albert King, Freddie King, a lot of those blues players, you know? But as far as rhythm players, like Jimmy Nolan, really knocked me out. Mighty Joe Young, who played on Can I Change My Mind by Tyrone Davis. You know, he was a blues player, but you would never know that was him grooving that. Reggie Young, who played on the intro to Son of a Preacher Man, and also played on Wilson Pickett's version of Bobby Womack's I'm in Love. You know, Billy Butler. Now, there's two Billy Butlers that I like. There's Billy Butler, who played with Bill Doggett on Honky Tonk, parts 1 and 2, and also Billy Butler, who played with Jerry Butler, or we know as the Iceman. There's a clip of him playing I Stand Accused, and just most beautiful stuff. Robert White, Eddie Willis, Joe Messina from the Funk Brothers, Teenie Hodges, who played behind Al Green and Ann Peebles. Those guys, the guys from the Wrecking Crew as well. It was always the session guys and the guys, the people that you wouldn't necessarily talk about, you know, that you don't hear in the magazines. Those were the people that really influenced me heavily, you know, outside the ones that we, you know, are household names, but it was always the people who were, you know, that you didn't necessarily hear about, but were in the studios doing what they did. You know, those were the guys who interested me a lot.
Did you think of the guitar more as a rhythmic or melodic instrument when you started?
You know, I thought of it a little bit of both, you know, but more rhythmic than anything. You know, I thought of it as a percussion, a drum or a percussion, you know, and more like, I'll give an example. He's not a guitarist, but he had a heavy influence on me. James Jamerson.
Right.
Was the great bassist for Motown.
Yeah.
That man had to be, the, in my opinion, the greatest genius on bass that I ever heard. And it's just like, you know, we all hear Motown, and it's, but it's his, what he could do rhythmically and melodically, and his note choices was just beyond me. I still listen to the stuff that he did, like his take on What's Going On, and then hear them live at the Save the Children concert in Chicago in 72. And how he approached it differently every time, it had a heavy influence on me. Heavy influence. Because I was like, this man could play different rhythms, patterns, and in cut time against what everybody else is doing and never get in the way of what everybody was doing, you know? And so that was that. Him teaching me that lesson, and my middle sister being a drummer taught me that lesson. My mother and my sister were my first teachers. My mother would like emphasize, listen to the melody. My sister would be like, tempo, pockets, everything, stay out the way. You play your part, but don't get in the way of everybody else. And then hearing how Jamerson approached that, like you can take a song like Darling Dear by the Jackson 5. And there's a strip mix, and you can hear Jamerson and Michael Jackson and the strings. And they're dancing around each other, but never getting in the way, you know? And it's just crazy. And it, just how he approached that is just like, Jamerson is one of those people I wish I could have had a conversation with, was like, what was your mind process to do what you did, you know? Or, you know, but, you know, he's not here. And a lot of people, the one person I would love to talk to would be Steve Cropper. That's one person I would love to just sit in a room. And I know the stuff that he would deal with, the stuff that he did, of course, with Booker T. But there's stuff I would have loved to ask him, like, what was your thought when you played on Candy by the Astors? You know, and stuff like that. Like, there's recordings that I'm sure he'd be like, how do you remember that? I'm like, because there's just stuff that he did that I would just love to sit here and... That's one of my wish list. On my wish list is to talk to that man.
Well, you know what? He's around, so we should like set it up where like I'll get him and you together, and you could interview him, and I'll just sit back and listen. I don't know if I could do it, but I had him on Carol Pop about a year and a half ago, maybe. I talked to him mostly about Otis Redding because Rhino had just put out this box set of kind of the posthumous Otis records, and he produced them all, and I was kind of asking about how he worked with Otis, but I really wanted to sort of do much more on Booker T and the MGs as well. And he's still with us. So I don't know. We'll see.
That's one person, like, I there's so many recordings he did. Like, there's stuff he did with Otis. I love their take of Solomon Burke's Down in the Valley, you know, and what he did on that, you know, and the you know, just hear certain stuff he did with the Astros or the Mad Lads. And, you know, it's there's a whole bunch of stuff that he did that I'm like, I was like, whoa, why did you, you know, what was your thought when you came up with that, you know? And you know, because I know it's like his catalog, you know, and just knowing his stuff, you know, and like, oh, what was your thought on this? Because I know he did some of that. I know that's his sound on some of that Wilson Pickett stuff on the Atlantic, you know, and hearing that. You know, but also like Eddie Floyd's, you know, Knock on Wood, you know, and stuff like that. And, you know, Soul Man, you know, all the Sam and Dave stuff. It's just interesting. It's always it always knocked me out because I'm a stickler for rhythm players more so than lead players. You know, like I dig what lead players do, but I really have knocked out my rhythm players, you know, more so. Another person I like to add, Nile Rodgers, is another person that I love. Like, Good Times is one of my favorite songs of all, one of my favorite songs of the 70s era. And it just, I just love what he does. You know, rhythm players just knock me out a lot.
Well, and both of them have something in common with you, which is that they have a good sense of space. You know, that they're sort of fitting into the space. They're not like overplaying. They're, you know, they're sort of creating their own space, but there's like air around it, you know, as opposed to their other guitarists who it just like fill all the space. And so it's like, it's all about them and not kind of that interplay with the rhythm and everything else.
Well, that's like, I remember doing a session with some friends of mine. Like I did a session with Kelly Finnegan. And he brought some of my favorite guys to play with, you know. One of them was actually running the boards, Sergio from Orgone. And then there was Joe Ramey from the Ironsides. And then he had Joey Crispiano, who played with the Dap Kings. And I remember, I called the two Joes, but one is, I'll call Ramey and then the other one Crispy. And us playing together, I remember we did the session and we're like figuring out our parts. And so I made a little thing. I said, hey, this is what we're going to do. In honor and in tribute of the Funk Brothers rhythm guitar section, I looked at Joe and said, you know what? You'll be Robert White. And so, you know, Robert White is more, everybody knows his sound for My Girl, of him playing that with his thumbnail. Crispy was like, he was playing. I said, okay, you're going to be Eddie Willis because you're playing these funky fills. I said, I'll be Joe Messina. You know, Joe Messina plays the backbeats, you know, and stuff like that. And listening to how that worked out, and it worked out great because we were able to, you know, figure out parts and doing that. And it's the same thing listening to, like, I listened to this isolated guitar track of Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell's Precious Love. And you hear now Joe Messina's doing a different part. He can read bass clef. And so he's doubling with Jamerson. And then you hear Robert White come in with the chords, and then you hear Eddie Willis, I think, do the backbeat. And they're doing all those parts, and everybody's answering each other, but they're in different parts of the neck board. And just listening how they played, or You Keep Me Hanging On. One guitar is doing the high octave, the other's doing the low octave. And they're playing simultaneously. And then I think Robert White is playing the chords, you know, and not one of them is getting in the way. The most beautiful thing to hear. But also James Brown did it too, you know, with people like Jimmy Nolan or Catfish Collins. But I remember like listening to Catfish Collins with Herlin Cheese Martin and how they play, you know, and it was just, they knew their parts, where their parts were. And like, that's what I always loved about James Brown was, I mean, his rhythm section was just, of course, you know, his band was always top notch, you know, no matter right. what. But just hearing stuff like take Lick and Stick, even though it's only one guitar and organ, you hear the guitar go, the organ's like, you know what I mean? And my mother played that song a lot too, you know, Lick and Stick, and it's a funky groove, and the bass line is just kicking. You know, when they got into like, I Know You Got Soul by Bobby Bird, you know, hear that guitar part. That's one of my favorite guitar parts in the world to play, you know, or Clean Up Woman, you know, Little Beaver, you know, doing what he did, and there was three right. guitars playing. It always worked.
Caropop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great beers include the classic Anti-Hero IPA and the premium lager, Cold Time. It's still hot out, and Cold Time still hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans, and you know, that blue-on-blue can design is pretty cool. Are you someone who has, like, a lot of guitars for, like, you know, I like this one with this and this one with that, and, you know, a lot of, I don't know, amps or effects boxes? Or are you someone who's just like, this is my guitar, this is the one I play?
Well, I play my main ones, you know. I play the Strat and I play the Silvertone. But my friend Johnny Ritchie from Fender, he made me a Strat, and he made me a Tele, which I use. Shout outs to him. He's one of my good friends from New York, but he lives, you know, he's in California. And so he had that made for me. It just depends, you know, but mostly it's always the Silvertone and always the Strat. Some other times also is the Jazzmaster too, which also Fender custom redid the electronics on it. I got a Guild a fan who actually passed away a few months back, gifted to me because he was having brain cancer. He was dealing with that, and so he invited me out and gave that to me as a gift, and, you know, and stuff like that. And so I'm forever indebted to him for that. And I use that for certain things, you know, and stuff like that. So it's just depends.
Was that an acoustic,
you
know, Guild or acoustic Guild or no, electric?
No, it's electric. It's a X170, I believe. So it's an archtop, hollow, big, thick hollow body. You can do a lot of things on it, you know, but usually it's like more, you can play more jazzy stuff, but I tend to still play like, I'll get together with my friend Tiffany Wilson, and we sometimes like we'll do like music by Aretha, stuff like that, you know, so Bobby Womack and all that. So I use it for that cause, but it all depends. And then I got a electric sitar that was made, acoustic and a electric bass, and a Strat that our horn player Gordon Brown was about to throw out. He gave it to me. He's like, "Man, this is cheap guitar." I said, I love cheap guitars. I don't care if they don't have a name on them. If you want them, I like them, because I'll do something with them, you know, because I like guitars that most people either throw out and say, "Oh, this is, I would never play that." And I love it because it has a character to it, you know, that you wouldn't normally hear, you know. So I love it. I'll take it. I'm like, "Oh, I love it. Let's play it," you know, and have fun with it. So I think an instrument should be reflective of yourself, you know, and it speaks to you as your anatomy or your extra vocal cord, I would say, you know, is the best way I could look at it. And it should fit your personality, you know. That's what I would say. That's the reason why I like the Silvertone and that, because it just fits and reflects and fits that personality, you know, and stuff. My bass, honestly, I have flat wounds that have been on there over 15 years, to be quite honest. It's been on there that long. Actually, let's just say it's been 20 years, actually. And it's dirty, cruddy. I don't care. I love it. It's a certain sound that I like. I don't like the strings to be brand new or anything like that. So.
Right. When you're playing at home, are you playing just by yourself, or do you put on something and sort of play along with it?
Sometimes I play along to certain things. Sometimes I'll have the guitars. Sometimes I have a guitar in the bathroom. That's true. I know I shouldn't say that, but it's true. In case you're sitting there, you're wondering, like, okay, you know, you an idea will come along, you know, you sit there and you're like, the guitar's sitting in the corner, that's all playing. So I have a guitar in each spot, like, what is in the room, what sometimes out the living room, what is in the bathroom. It's just like, and I carry my phone or my iPad with me, so in case ideas happen, I'll play it and be like, okay, You in the sleep, I'll have something, I'm hearing something in my dream, and I'm like, oh, let me wake up, let me record it, and then go back to sleep.
So go into, you know, like the True Loves or Parlor Greens and say, all right, here's this riff I came up with, and, you know, let's turn this into a song, and like, or do you tend to come up with stuff more like when you're already in the room with the other musicians?
I usually, most of the time, is either in the room. Sometimes I have some ideas that I bring to the table. Sometimes it's just, you know, you'll catch somebody playing a beat or something, you know, like Dave McGraw, he'll like in the True Loves, he'll play something, you know, because, you know, he'll play something on the drums. I'll catch him playing something. I'm like, what's that? And he'll be like, oh, I said, play that again. I love it. You know, and then he'll start playing it. And Brian, you know, he'll pick up wherever, or Brian will be playing something, or the horns will play something, or Yvonne will play something on percussion. You know, same thing with Parlor Greens. It's like, you'll catch somebody riffing something. You're like, what's that? Oh, it's just messing around. Okay, play it again. I might have something to add to it. And you start playing to it, you know, and stuff. Or Tim was playing some kind of thing. You know, you're like, what's that? Oh, okay. You know, one of us is ripping somewhere.
Right.
And if you catch it, and you're just like, you know, and hopefully the tape is rolling right as that's happening, you know. And that's a good thing. You know, you never know if like, oh, man, I can't remember what I just played there. You know, stuff like that. So it's like certain ideas happen that way, you know.
So like, what's your sort of happiest place among your happy place? Is it when you're, you know, with the other musicians and you guys are coming up with stuff and jamming? Is it when you're on stage performing songs that you've already come up with? Or is it maybe when you're in the studio nailing stuff down?
I would say it's all of it. You know, it's like you catch, I would say it's like you're surfing and you catch that wave, you know? And when that wave rises up, you're riding that wave. Whether it, maybe you fall off the board, but you're almost about to fall off the board, but you're kind of just like you're hanging in there, like, okay, where are we going with this? I'd have no idea, but you know what? Let's just do it and see what happens, you know. And when you do that, it's one of the most funnest things ever, because we're kind of like, you're just like, I'm holding on to this board for dear life, and I don't know if I'm gonna in the water like this, but it's sure fun doing it, you know. So it's always fun. It's like on stage, and then on stage, you know, certain things change a little bit because you're like, okay, maybe we're going to extend this out, you know, let's see where this is going to lead. And sometimes you never know where it's going to lead. You're like, here, keep that going, I like that, okay, I'm gonna try some over here, let's try this will be fun. And you know, it happens the way it happens. So that's always the fun part. You know, it's just, I love just going into the unknown territory, you know, and if it works, it works, you know.
Would you ever do a solo album, or are you just a band guy?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because I can't tell you how many times I've been asked that question. And let's just say Terry has mentioned it quite a few times. He said it. There are people who have asked me over a couple times. And I'll be honest with you, I get really nervous with it being like, I know some people like, just go for it. But I'm always nervous when it's like, okay, it's Jimmy James and this, and I feel so weird about it. I always have, because I was like, oh, that's a lot of pressure. You know, that's a lot of pressure to be like, oh, God, I got to really do this now, because right. It's like, I was, you know, because there's been certain situations I have to do where it's just like, you know, Brian, those guys had like a side project, but they call it the Jimmy James Gang, or the other group is Jimmy James and the Sure Things. And I feel like, I really got it. I like the group thing, you know, the group name thing, because it's easier, because therefore I'm like, I'm part of the group, you know, I've always been like that. And I come to realize that is a thing that ran in my family, because my mother, she was in a group called the Champels. And she was a singer, and she loved being in the background harmonizing. You know, that was her thing. And then her bandmates were like, you're going to have to be the lead singer. And she didn't want to do that. She loved being in the back harmonizing. And that's always been my thing. I like to be in the background playing, because I could just, you know. But and then sometimes you have to be like, okay, I gotta be. And it's different for me. But I have been asked by different friends and even label mates, like, have you thought about it? Have you really thought about doing it? And there's an offer to do it, and either like want me to do a record, you know, or maybe start out doing some singles and try it that way and see what happens. And the one time I did do something similar to that was at a festival, and I actually got up and did it for the first time in front of people, and it was recorded, and I was playing and singing, which
I was going to ask if you're going to. I was going to ask if you would sing or if it would just be an instrumental thing. But yeah, singing. All right.
Yeah, I did a version. And it was the first time I actually did it in front of people. And there's probably it's on Instagram somewhere. You know, some people found it. And I got up and I did "When Cries Mary," but I did it in a different way, and I did it solo by myself, just guitar and vocal, and I was just scared out of my wits to do it. But and then next thing you know, the band joined, and it was David McGraw, my friend Evan Floyd Barnes, and I said I'm gonna do this song in tribute, because the festival they gave me my own stage to close out the whole night. So it was like celebration of Jimmy James or something like that. Shout out to Kevin Sir from Timberfest. And they had me do it. And we did, I swear I would never do that song again, because my mother loved the song Run House. She just loved that song. And I was like, and the last time I sung it for her was at her bedside before she passed. Because she always asked me to do that too. She's like, I love that song, and I love to hear you play it and sing it. And so I sung it right next to her a few days before she passed. And I swear, I was like, I don't know if I can do this song again. And I remember getting up on stage, and I did the first intro of it, and I was about to start singing it, and I got nervous. I got cold feet. I was like, I don't know if I can pull this off, or if I can really do this. And next thing you know, it was the most ironic thing, because I looked into the audience and I could see a silhouette of my mother in the crowd, in the front row. And in the video, and my friends noticed that, they said, we know she looked off into the distance. I said, yes, because I could see her. And I saw her like give a nod of approval, like, and I could hear her say, dig deeper. It was her thing. You know, she always tell me that. So I took a deep breath and I went for it and did it. And then my friend Eva from the Black Tones, she got out and she was with me when my mother passed. So she was with me, and my mother just loved her band. And she heard it. She called me up and really was just like, how come you didn't tell me you sang? And I was like, I didn't want anybody to know. She's like, it's all over social media. Everybody's sharing it. And I'm like, no. She's like, you know what? I'm going to take that audio and I'm going to play it on KXP. And I said, you wouldn't. She's like, watch me. I said, whatever. So I shined it off. I was like, whatever. And all of a sudden, the Trullo's on the road. We're on our way back to Seattle. I get a text message from people. Hey, tune into KXP right now. I said, what? Tune into KXP right now. So the band is sitting there. I said, tune in. And they tune it in. All of a sudden, I hear my voice singing Red House all over the radio. And I'm like, oh, and I called. I said, you did? She's like, that's right, I did. She's like, and you know what? You know your mom wanted you to do that. And you know, you're not, and we know you, Jimmy, that you would never say no, because whatever your mom says, you go ahead and do it, because you can be stubborn sometimes. You won't listen. So, but when your mother says it, you'll listen. I said, but that's my mother. me and my mother, we're so close together, because our birthdays are 4 days apart in August. She's the 21st of August, I'm the 25th. And so they said, but you know, that's what your mother wanted, you know, was you to sing that song for her. And so I said, you know what? You're right. You're right. And so I went for it. And I believe, I know she was there that day. You know, I know because there's no way I could have just not saw that. And because I was not going to play the song, I was basically just going to, like, you know, freeze up. But my mother would not allow that at all. She's just like, nice. No, dig deeper.
Had you practiced singing it at that point, or?
Not really too much. I just went for it. I just went for it with all I had, you know, and stuff like that. And it's on Instagram somewhere. Somebody got it. One of the guys, oh, I know who it is. His name is McKenzie. He got it posted on his page, on his Instagram, like an Instagram reel. So it's out there for the masses to see.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go find it now.
Yeah. And it was. And I was just so nervous, you know, because I guess after, you know, it's like you play around a lot of great singers and stuff, you get self-conscious, you know. But I would always tell that to my mom. She's like, look, she's like, put it this way. She's like, Hendrix didn't feel comfortable about his voice. He still got out there and did it. Bob Dylan went out there and did it. He made some of it. What's to be scared of? Just hold the tune, you know, and sing for your gut. So I was like, all right.
Have you written songs with lyrics that would be on your solo debut?
I have some stuff. One song I do have, I wrote in like less than 5 minutes. And it was about my mother. And it was just, and every time I look at the lyrics, I remember singing it into my phone. Or I think either my phone or my iPad. But it was so hard to sing afterwards. It was like, hearing it was like breaking down, crying after singing it, because it was everything I, you know, like, you know, just how, what she meant to me. And it was just hard to sing it, you know, and it still is, you know. I'm sure I could get through it, but I'm sure my voice would crack, you know, doing so, you know. I mean, there's songs I've written, you know, for other people, you know, and stuff like that, music-wise, or some lyrical stuff, you know. But, you know, I guess I take my cue from people like Smokey Robinson or Carole King, you know, people like that, Curtis Mayfield, you know, Burt Bacharach, you know, Hal David. I love their songwriting, you know, all the stuff they did for Dionne Warwick and stuff. But yeah, that was, sorry, a whole tear up over here. But it's going to be a very hard song to sing without getting a lump in my, like a lot of lumps in my throat, you know?
Right. Well, it's great that she's able to inspire you that way, even though it's also hard. So
she's always inspired me. She was my first critic and my first supporter, you know? Because I remember the funny story, a little tidbit was she told me, I remember I first played the talent show and I did a solo. And I asked my mom, I said, Mom, tell me the truth. What do you think? She's like, truth? You played the first three notes, right? Everything goes off, you know? And she was just, but she was brutally honest, you know? She's from the South, you know? That's just how they were, you know? And she just told it like it was because she's from Texas, you know? And they were tough on you in those days, you know? And then she saw, the one show she saw me with my friends from the Black Tones. And they were opening up for Mavis Staples. So it was her birthday week. And the photo on my Instagram, there's the photo of her with her hands on the rose. That's the photo she taken after she had me. And then that photo, the photo that follows right after that, where I'm leaning my head into her, was actually the last show she got to see me play at. Mm. And I remember being so nervous. And I said, why is your hand sweaty? Why is your hand so sweaty? I never seen you so sweaty before. I said, my mom is in the crowd, you know? It's like, you know, and she was in the crowd. She was next to the sound guy, so she got a full view. And I was just like, and I was so nervous because I always wanted to know what she thinks, you know, because she always just tells me the truth. And so the next time I said, Mom, what do you think? She said, honestly, it was fantastic. I loved it. And she's like, you come a long way. And she was very happy. And to get those words, her words, to me, mean more than anything in the world, more than anything, you know. and get her, she got so excited. And I remember she was in her wheelchair, and I wheeled her to the backstage, and then, like, because I had just came in from Europe, so nobody knew I was back until I was showing up there. And then everyone's like, is that your mom? And I said, yep, that's my mom. And so everybody runs past me. They were like, and they get to her. They were like, are you his mom? You know what he always talks, Jimmy always talks about all the time. My mom this, my mom that. Only to realize that my mom did the same thing, because people who knew her was like, my son this, my son that, my son this, you know? And so all these people gathered around her, and they're like, you want anything to drink? You want anything to eat? Anything you want? Your son talks about you all the time. You're like, you are his heart, everything. That's all he ever talks about is, I got to call my mom. I got to call my mom. No matter where he is on the road, he's got to call his mom, you know? And so once she got back, she was just like, she was just beaming, you know, so happy. And she said, what did you tell him? And I said, why? She's like, they wanted to know everything, like everything. She's like, they were just in awe of who I was, you know? And I said, mom, you're famous, you know? And she's like, they treated me like a queen, like I was a queen or something. And I said, mom, cause you're the queen of my heart. And I want everybody to know it, that you are the queen to me. And that's what I wrote on her gravestone. And she's like, you didn't have to do all that for me. And I said, mom, I want to let you know, you're everything to me. I always told her that, you know, always. But she was just, you know, and then her birthday came a few days later, and, you know, bought all this huge cake. Well, of course, she got mad at first. She's like, who's going to eat all this cake? This is a cake for like 10 people or more. I said, well, it's your birthday week. You get to eat it every day, and ice cream, and, you know, and stuff like that. And she's just like, but she always, you know, she didn't like, you know, she didn't want all the big hoopla, you know. She was always telling me, I'm just a simple country girl who just, you know, likes the small things in life, you know. She just likes the simple things in life, and that's just how she was. But, you know, but whenever I ran up to her and just wanted to know everything about her, of course, she, you know, how parents like to do, they like to also embarrass you, but like, here, you want to see a picture of him when he was a baby? Look at him. He was so cute. Look at him. And then he would talk, and she'll, you know, parents, what they do. And she would tell them, she's like, yeah, I remember when he was a little kid, he talked about, you know, he eat his boogers and stuff like that. Just, you know, and he would talk about that stuff, and just, he just loved to just talk about that. And I was like, mom, okay, you don't have to tell him the whole story. It's like, oh, hush up, boy. So anyway, my son would do this, right? And I'm sitting there like, and I'm like, oh my God, he wants to see some pictures of him? This is what he looked like when he was in kindergarten, and da da da. And I was like, and I thought it was pretty, just the whole thing, you know, as parents do, you know, they like to, and, you know, embarrassed. She's like, but he's still my baby, you know, and stuff like that. So it was always beautiful, you know, and stuff like that. I love my mom for that, you know, even though she would always, but every kid, every parent embarrasses their kid, though.
Yeah.
You know, that's just how it is, you know.
Well, so, I'm sorry she's not with you anymore, but I'm glad she is with you forever, you know. I lost my mom like in 96. So it's like, you know, it's, yeah, you carry that with you all the time. So
right, and my condolences.
Yeah, it's been a while, but it's always fresh, you know. And but it's also like, you know, it's great to, you know, we have a phrase, you know, may her memory be a blessing, and you know, it's, you carry it around with you, and it is. So
yeah, she's always there. Even her dialysis nurse, he sometimes comes up and visits. He says, you know, he said he's watched a lot of people pass in front of him working in medical profession. He said, but nothing hit as hard as losing my mother. Cause he, you know, as a medical professional, you're not supposed to get close to your, right. You know, but he said, your mom was one of those people who was like a magnet, you know, her gravity was so strong. She pulled you in, whether you didn't even know you did it, you know. He's like, your mom can give me a look. He's like, I named my first child. I'm a better father, and your mom helped me name my first child.
Wow.
You know, and he said, you know, and she could always communicate by cutting you with those eyes. I said, oh, you mean this? And I looked at him like that. He's like, I looked at him like, he's like, yeah, you have your mom's the same exact look. We cut that look. I said, who you think I learned it from? I learned it from her. She can do that. He said, but a lot of times I go to your mom's grave and I just sit there and I just ask for advice because she can always give it to me, you know? And he said, I never had, and you know, he ended up quitting the medical profession soon after that. And he's worked in it for over a decade. He said, but your mother's passing, he's like, you know, I'm a better person and I'm a better man because she existed. And he said, after dealing with it, after a year, he came to work every day and they expected her to be there and she was not there. And he said he couldn't deal with it. He said he quit. He quit. And some people there, after her passing, quit the medical profession and no longer work in medical, no more, because they said it just, her passing really put a huge void and a huge thing on that most of them never wanted to do it no more.
Wow.
And so he no longer works in that.
Well, she sounds incredible. So, you know, yeah. And you know, you're playing music that you were inspired by from stuff you heard on her records from when you were growing up. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. She was also the one who bought me the Strat, you know.
There you go.
That's, yeah, you know, and so she always comes, she's like, you like to play old Bessie? That's what, because that was my nickname for, that's my nickname for my Strat, because I nicknamed her for my favorite blues singer of all time, Bessie Smith, the Empress of Blues. And so she's like, you gonna play old Bessie tonight? You gonna play old Bessie? You know, so yeah, we did a lot of that. I always follow the one saying that the great James Jamerson told his son, if you don't feel it, don't play it. You know? And I will add to that, to answer to that, is play what moves you, play what's 100% you, because if it isn't, you have to go back to the drawing board and find out what it is that moves you.
Right.
You know, and I mean, you can get so many different styles, and I think some people will say, oh, I can play all these different styles, and that's great, but what's those styles that move you the most, you know? It doesn't have to be multiple. It could be one, if that's the case. But find the music that moves you the most, you know? And that's how I approach it, you know, and I've always approached it that way. You know, it's just, you know, I could go and play all this other stuff, but I was like, no, this is what I love to play. You know, this is when I wake up in the morning, that's all I want to play. There's nothing else, you know? It's like, I'll put on a record, I'll play To Shotgun by Junior Walker and All-Stars over and over again if I need to. You know, it's just those things, you know.
Well, I love your playing. Sorry. And I love your music, and I really appreciate it and appreciate you, and look forward to that Parlor Greens album getting out into the world, and hopefully you guys will bring the music to Chicago and everywhere else, so everyone who's listening can hear it live too. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
That's all for episode 143 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Jimmy James for opening up about his music, his mother, and all that has inspired him. Parlor Green's debut album, In Green We Dream, is out now, and you can order it directly from the label, Coal Mine Records, or its retail partner, Plaid Room Records, which is at plaidroomrecords.com. Act now and you can get the limited edition green vinyl version. In Green We Dream also is streaming everywhere you'd want it to stream. Follow Jimmy James on Instagram at JimmyScratchJames and learn more about Parlor Greens at parlorgreens.com and The True Loves at truelovesband.com. The True Loves have 3 shows in Oregon and Washington in August. Parlor Greens have an early September date in Seattle and 4 shows scheduled in late October in Austin, Houston, Dallas, and Nashville. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who also shines without overplaying. For a mere $24, you can become a Caropop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at caropop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caropop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at caropopcast. And you can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caropop conversation. Thanks.